Accession number 21095, Reel 10.
I haven't said very much about Wiesenthal's relationship with Kreisky, which in a way can be traced back to the various allegations that the East Europeans fostered, various allegations that the East Europeans made against him, that he had been a Gestapo collaborator during the war. The Polish Communist Party, started that particular ball rolling because their governments, especially in the earlier post-war period, contained quite a few people who were pronounced anti-Semitic, and they wanted to tar Simon Wiesenthal with whatever brush they could to diminish any impact that he might be making, and they consistently fed propaganda against him into their mass media, which is a term that I hate using, but anyway, into their media. The East Germans picked on this after Wiesenthal exposed the fact that the German Democratic Republic had in fact continued to employ known Nazis in far larger numbers than anything that had taken place in West Germany, or indeed even in Austria, I think. But he published a pamphlet which showed that the whole East German regime was infested with a lot of former Nazi party members, even though they always presented themselves as being purer than the pure, and certainly far better than West Germany. And they were incensed by this and countered with spreading still more rumors about his alleged collaboration with the Gestapo. And then, if one sort of jumps ahead to the early 70s, when Bruno Kreisky fell out with was infuriated by Wiesenthal's activities in Austria, both exposing the sort of Nazis still in the civil service and so on, and above all exposing Friedrich Peter, the leader of the Austrian Freedom Party, as an SS officer who allegedly had been involved in killings in Poland and so on, and he felt that this was undermining his efforts to draw a line under the past, that he suddenly had this outburst questioning Wiesenthal's credentials for speaking out against Nazis. It soon became clear to me when I compared what I saw the Poles and the East Germans had been saying about him to the words and the whole gist of what Kreisky was implying, that he must have seen some of those reports. Some of them, incidentally, were secret intelligence reports, which I found during my research about Wiesenthal, which had been circulated secretly, and which I also found from the Stasi accounts of what Wiesenthal was purported to have done. But Kreisky must somehow have had access to some of these reports and based his remarks on that. Now, of course, at the time when all this happened, the outside world and the media certainly were unaware of the precise details of what was being alleged against him, because that was all in secret documents that were not published. Or anyway, only very partially published. And this is something that I realized partly through my independent research, partly what I found in the Kreisky archive, And this, of course, I found fascinating. Equally interesting, I found, was the lengths to which Kreisky seems to have been concerned by the worldwide reaction to his attempts to criticize Wiesenthal, because every Austrian embassy had been asked to do weekly reports on what the local press in whatever country they were in was saying about all this, and this was all sent to the chancellor for his direct attention. So he certainly realized that he had launched something that was not being very helpful to him, though at the time he acted partly because he lost his temper, and he did that very easily, and partly because he thought that this was necessary in order to strengthen his position in Austria. But while it may have strengthened his position in Austria and rallied people around him there, it certainly didn't do him much good in terms of his international reputation, and that is something that he was trying to establish at the time, at least as much as trying to improve his credibility in his own domestic backyard.
Kreisky was Jewish, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes, Kreisky was Jewish, but Kreisky was somebody who would, well, he didn't deny that he was Jewish because he couldn't, but he certainly saw himself as someone who was assimilated 150%, and who wanted to be known on his political record and not for being a Jew. And in fact, and I think this is something that I found in my later book about Austria, which shocked me even more, is the depth of his, I think, deeply felt anti-Semitism. And he wanted to be a neutral mediator, in a sense, in the Middle East, but his anti-Israeli feelings were so strong that I think he could never really have been objective in his handling of Middle East questions. He was a very curious mix, Kreisky, and I think perhaps we'll get back to that later on, because he did play an important role in the Cold War, and he certainly did a huge amount to put Austria on the map. And certainly it helped to put Austria on the map that this controversy about Wiesenthal broke out, because, as I said, the whole world was writing about Wiesenthal, about him, and about Austria. So even though it was negative, at the same time, it was also positive in terms of making Austria more of a known quantity in a world where people until then had probably found it even harder than they do now to distinguish between Austria and Australia. Wiesenthal could, of course, have gone to Israel at some point, after the Eichmann trial, had he wanted to. And he certainly enjoyed, while he was well enough, going to Israel at least once a year to stay with his daughter. But he never wanted to live there. I think partly because he knew that had he gone there, he would have been sucked into some kind of machinery, an organization that would have involved other people all engaged in the effort of trying to track down war criminals and having them tried for their crimes. He is a loner. I saw this more and more. And again, as I think I'd hinted earlier, he never really went in for any fundraising, either in Israel, where he certainly has some, certainly has detractors, but he also has many admirers. And I'm sure if he'd really set about it, he could have raised funds in Israel for his work in Vienna, and could have made the documentation center at least a little bit bigger and more methodical in the way it functions. But I think he never really wanted to. I talked to him about this, and he said, yes, I could have done more fundraising, but... And I think the but simply is that he didn't want to be an organization. He always wanted to be a one-person enterprise. And I found, again, this goes back to his wife. I remember when I went with him on the trip to Poland, various people said he spoke such wonderful Polish, old Polish, some old-fashioned Polish. And I said to him that, you know, so many people have admired your Polish, and he sort of shrugged it off. And I said, I suppose you keep it all going, talking to your wife. And he just looked at me and he said, oh, I don't talk much to my wife. Now, he's hugely linked to his wife, totally dependent on her emotionally. And yet, he said to me, well, I never discuss my work with her because it frightens her, it worries her too much. So, he keeps all this bottled up in himself. I mean, he really, other than his one longtime secretary, he really has no confidants with whom he wants to could discuss anything, but I don't think he has any need to discuss it. I also don't think he discusses with his secretary. I think it's simply that she knows, and he knows that she knows what he's doing, and there's a sort of unspoken understanding between them that they each understand what the other is up to, but I don't think so. That there's more. And then I remember in New York once, the Wiesenthal Center has an office in New York, which is run by a very attractive young woman. And she said to me one day, she's a great admirer of Simon Wiesenthal's, and she said to me, do you think he's had many affairs? And I said to her, I don't think he's had any affairs, because certainly in Vienna, you can't get away with affairs without somebody knowing about them. And I certainly never had heard anybody mention to me, talk to me Wiesenthal in the context of any woman. And yet, it's quite clear from photographs that he was a very attractive man. Much bigger. He's not much. He's really much shrunk now. But you can still tell that he even though he has the most extraordinary ears, I've never seen anybody whose ears stand out almost at right angles to their face. But he was big, and I think probably an attractive man. But I just don't think he bothered very much either about friends or about his relationships with women. I mean, his wife is exactly his own age. They were childhood sweethearts. He certainly, I think, loves her as much as he can love anybody, and he's wholly dependent on her, and I'm convinced that when she dies, that I don't think he will live much beyond that, because I don't think he's capable of living without her. On the other hand, I was always struck when his habit has been to go to the office every morning. He's always there before 9 o'clock, even at the age of 92, he's still in his office before 9 o'clock in the morning. And he stays till about 12:30, and then he goes home. And I found when I was with him that sort of come 12 o'clock, his wife would phone and first of all try to find out whether he was leaving on time, and secondly sort of give him orders of what he should shop on the way home, because she didn't go out to the shops anymore. And so he had to go and get bread and whatever. And then there was one time they have a housekeeper, they lost their housekeeper, and there was sort of total disorder. I just don't know what happened at home, but it must have been very difficult. And I remember once their boiler had apparently broken down, and she kept on ringing up every 5 minutes asking him to talk to the repair people and so on. I mean, it was really everything was on him. I mean, it was, and yet, his wife was his absolute sort of one serious emotional commitment, and his daughter and his grandchildren. But I noticed that the daughter, who came to Austria from time to time, she's an analyst herself, married to an analyst, a Dutch Jew, and they'd emigrated to Israel. And she never stayed with them. She always stayed in a hotel, because I think she probably felt she couldn't stand the proximity of both the parents constantly, even for such a short period. But she would not have said that to me. And this was from my point of view, just simply deduction. I also felt that one reason why she had emigrated to Israel was probably just to maintain some distance from the parents. But I could be quite wrong. I just didn't get close enough to that. But you know, the sort of central fact is that Wiesenthal, his friendships were mostly with people with whom he worked in some way or another. I think the friendships were always just confined to their work. He didn't socialize. I think even as a younger man, he didn't go to theaters. There's no indication that he was fond of music. He was a completely one-track, tunnel-vision man, interested in Jewish history, Jewish tradition, not religious. This was the curious part about him, that he was not a practicing Jew. His relationship with the chief rabbi in Vienna and the Jewish community, I think, was very much at arm's length. I think they respected each other, but it was certainly not a close friendship. The man who was the head of the Jewish community while I was doing the book, who's retired since then, he always spoke to me of Wiesenthal with the greatest of respect, but there was no closeness between them either. I don't think anyone ever was allowed to get too close to Wiesenthal.
Did he get any support from the Jewish people in Austria or any other organization?
Well, when he first established himself in Vienna, he was in fact, they lent him premises, the Jewish community in Vienna, but he fell out with them, as he fell out with many other people. And there, because the community, the leaders of the community in Vienna, are always very, it's a very political group, and in his time they were sort of divided half between those who supported the socialists and half who supported the conservatives. And even though Wiesenthal always says that he is apolitical, there's no doubt in my mind at all that he has always been anti-socialist and pro the Austrian People's Party, the Conservative Party. And he quarreled with members of the Jewish community at the time in 1961-62, when he was working from their premises, because of various deals that they did with the government of Vienna and so on and so forth, and with the Socialist Party, and then they stopped subsidizing him, and he set up his own bureau. But this is just one more example of one more illustration of his problems in working with other people, even though their aims may be very similar. He's also had a spectacular falling out with someone who runs something called the Jewish Welfare Service in Welcome Service in Vienna, who again does as much as he possibly can to denigrate Wiesenthal, and Wiesenthal reciprocates.
So no financial support from Jewish organizations?
Not after that first initial period. No, I mean, as I say, the only consistent financial support that he's had was from this small foundation in Holland, which developed after he had been there and given the lecture. I think I can't recall it. I described the circumstances in my book, but I can't recall it at the moment. But they collected money on his behalf, and he got a very small income from then. But you know, because the pot, the financial pot, was so small to start with, and it hasn't grown very much. So that, I mean, this has just all been minimal. No, he puts out a yearly newsletter, which is distributed to, you know, hundreds, tens of thousands of people all over the world. And in response to that, I think people just send him voluntarily send him sums of, you know, small sums of money. But it's always been hit and miss. And as far as I could tell, his sort of chief source of income has always been his books, because his books sold very well for a time. And he must have made enough money, but just to keep going. But I mean, his life has essentially been extremely modest in every respect. And as I say, I mean, he takes one, now he doesn't take holidays anymore at all, but once a year they used to go on holiday. And otherwise they live in a small house on the outskirts of Vienna. He was driving an ancient Mercedes, and he once drove me somewhere, and I was just amazed that I survived it, and I couldn't understand how he had survived his own driving for all those years. Nowadays he doesn't drive anymore, but he only gave up about 1999, I think. So he went on risking his daily life for a very long time. But you know, there is no, I mean, he had one good suit which he always put on for special occasions, and other than that, you know, I would see him day after day in the same sort of rather shabby trousers and tweed jackets, and you know, he was neat and clean, but certainly there were no extravagances there. It must always have been a hand-to-mouth existence.
You were saying also, though, how he sort of broadened his research on the Holocaust and included other groups other than Jewish people as victims, gypsies, you mentioned, for instance.
Well, look, he's always been against generalizing. The Holocaust, I mean, sorry, over making generalizations in every respect. First of all, he was always insistent that the Jews don't own the Holocaust, and that Hitler systematically tried to exterminate Jews, I mean, tried to exterminate not only Jews, but gypsies, minorities of every kind, certainly homosexuals, certainly disabled people, and that by the say on, that's on one side of the equation, that the equation is in fact much broader than Jewish communities sometimes like to portray it. But on the other side, that not every German, not every Austrian was a Nazi, not everyone was a perpetrator. It was interesting because the book about Hitler's willing executioners was published actually after, fairly recently, and I still had an opportunity to discuss that with him when he was still really thinking very clearly about these things. And I mean, he was outraged by the thesis that every German had been Hitler's willing executioner, or indeed, you know, that the Nazis were the product of centuries of cultural activity against the thesis that Hitler and the Nazis were the product of at least two centuries worth of propaganda of anti-Semitic teaching, in which had penetrated the sort of whole German culture at least 200 years. I mean, he totally disagreed with that, and you know, he argued that you cannot generalize. There's no such thing as collective guilt, and the implication of the Goldhagen book is collective guilt, and that you have to distinguish, and single out even Nazis who behaved well in the camps. And one of the interesting things that I found that after the Mauthausen was liberated, one of the first things that he did in order to persuade the Americans that he wanted to work with them in their search for Nazis, that he made a list of all the Nazis that he had of all the war criminals that he personally encountered. But in that list, he also put the names of two or three, including his camp commandant in Lvov, who had, in spite of being Nazis, had tried to help rather than kill Jews. And he has always insisted on this thing that you have to be fair, that there were some people, even right in the upper echelons of the party, of the Nazi party, who were not prepared either to condone or go along with the final solution. I think gradually his point of view has come to be appreciated much more. He really fought quite an uphill battle in his early days trying to get this point across. But it is often said that Wiesenthal concentrated so much on the Holocaust that he ignored Stalin and the deaths of millions of people in the gulags. I think to some extent that is true. He did, I mean, his focus has been the Holocaust, but he certainly didn't try to ignore it or to belittle it, but he just didn't feel that that was his task. And it's true, you know, I say that he's against generalization, and he's just as interested to show that the Holocaust is not a unique phenomenon, except in the sense that it combined at that time modern technology with the desire to exterminate whole groups of people. But he didn't focus on Stalin's machinations as much as he should have done. I think he felt that he had to leave that to others. He has not in any sense campaigned for trying any communist leaders for their work for collaborating with Stalin. I think this was all too far removed from him. Poland, yes, he understood just about, but Poland he associated with the Holocaust, not with Stalin. And after all, you know, Stalin did go. Stalin had gone by the time he became as active as he. I mean, Stalin went in 1952, and at that time, Simon Wiesenthal was still, not quite a nobody, but almost a nobody in Austria, still beavering away with Eichmann and various other bits and pieces, but he certainly hadn't become a significant figure. And once Stalin was gone, and he tended, I think, to see the communist regimes much more in terms of how they viewed the Holocaust and how they behaved themselves with respect to the Holocaust, and far less with respect to Stalin and what he had done with the gulags. And, you know, added to that, I think it's at least worth asking oneself whether, if he had indeed been helped by by the communist underground in Poland, that certainly included Russian Soviet elements, whether that might have influenced him in some way, the way he looked at the whole. At the Soviet perspective with regard to the Gulag.